Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Valentine's Day. Whether it's your favorite day of the season or you avoid it like the plague, there's no debating, it's a big day for the world of food and hospitality.
Valentine's Day is what we refer to in the industry as a blackout day.
I don't feel that my manlyhood is threatened when I order a glass of rosé or, God forbid, a rosé champagne.
It's an old Jamaican drink from way back, and we just decided to bring it back into existence. It's a drink that the men, they believe it really does wonders.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Kiko Katayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding Japanese cuisine and America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi ramen in izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Ron Silver, who is the chef owner of Bubby's. Bubby's opened in 1990 and is now one of the iconic American restaurants in New York City, serving delicious breakfast, burgers, pancakes, as well as beautiful pies. What you may not know about Bubby's is that there are 6 Bubby's locations in Japan now. So today we'll discuss why and how Ron decided to open Bubby's in Japan and his experience with Japanese market and culture and how he is inspired by Japan as a chef and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Needs is available on the Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Needs. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. Now let's start our conversation with Ron Silver. Hello, Ron. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is really exciting. I'm a big fan of Bubby's. So first of all, I heard you are born in Brooklyn and moved to Utah.
I was born in Manhattan.
Okay.
And I believe I was conceived in Brooklyn,
though. Oh, okay.
And moved to Utah at a young age.
Right. And what did you eat when you grew up?
That is a very interesting question. My mother was a very experimental cook because she was from New York City. So we had a lot of strange, gourmet magazine kind of meals. And the people around me were very much eating what I would call sort of trashier food,
mm.
which I really had a great love for early on.
Like everybody else, I guess.
Yes, like American, you know, macaroni and cheese and pork chops with mushroom gravy and things like that.
Mm. Well, that's interesting, right? Because I think it's not so bad. If you cook it well with good ingredients, they're pretty good food too.
It's amazing. you know, it really is good food. It can be a little heavy, American food, I think. But when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was really very much about a packet of this and a can of that. So it wasn't really that good. It wasn't healthy, but it was delicious.
Right. Okay, so you became into cooking because of your mother's experience and the experiments, maybe you would rather.
Well, I think that she absolutely had a big influence on me in all kinds of things that I do. And I also just had a natural curiosity for all kinds of, you know, I sort of had an early map of where everything was growing. I grew up in a place where things still grew wild. There was sort of agriculture and suburban crashing up against each other. So there was wild asparagus growing in the spring and peas and grapes and apples and all kinds of things. I kind of knew where all of those things were. And I also started cooking at a very young age.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Again, because of your mother?
Because my mother forbid me to play with knives and fire. I think that was more like that.
Right. So you went against whatever she said.
Yes, I love mischief.
Right. So actually, you didn't go to culinary school, but you came to New York and started cooking. Is that what happened?
Well, I decided at a certain point, I started washing dishes when I was young. About 13, and I just thought that was going to be my job forever because I really liked it. And then I decided at some point to become a cook. And I was going to go to cooking school, but I just started cooking, and then I moved to Atlanta when I was about 21 and worked for some really good people there, and then I moved to New York when I was offered a job in New York City.
So who offered you a job?
Well, I was flown here to cook a party for 450 people at the Guggenheim Museum.
Wow.
And that company offered me a job to be the chef of the catering company.
Sounds like a major opportunity.
It was great. Great to land here with a job. Unfortunately, I only kept that job for about 3 days due to my love of mischief. And deep down unemployability.
Okay, so should I ask you about what you did?
No.
Okay. Well, maybe not next time.
Certainly mischievous, I would say, and almost harmless, but you know, not professional.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe later off the record. And then you worked at Florent?
Yes, after I was a chef, I'm also an artist, and so I decided to take an easier job cooking eggs at Florent.
That's another iconic, sad to say it's closed now, but it was amazing.
Well, strangely, I have Bubby's Highline is right next door to where Florent was, and a block away from where my other job was, the catering chef job.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's your destiny to stay in that area, sounds like.
I suppose so.
Right. So how did you find experience at the Florent? Because it's such a, I think, influential place in many ways for artists and as a cook, maybe.
Well, you know, the reason I worked there is because I ate there before and I took a job that I was very much overqualified for, just cooking eggs. So it was fun. I mean, really cooking for people from, you know, 7 in the morning until whatever, 11. It's right. A good crowd of people at Florent.
Right. And it's such a interesting community, right? The customers, and I'm sure it was very inspiring for you.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. Roy Lichtenstein and, you know, and lots of interesting people and artists and you know, just the people that were around town at that time.
Right. So in 1990, you opened the Bubby's in Tribeca at the corner of Hudson and Northmore Street. So why did you open it?
Well, I landed there in a because it was available to use while somebody was trying to sell their business. It was a sort of vacant kitchen. And I had a deal with the person who had the lease there that we could use the kitchen, but nobody could know we were there. And which was difficult because the entire neighborhood really smelled like pie, and I'd started a pie company. And, you know, we were doing pretty well right from the beginning. And a lot of people in the neighborhood just started coming up to the back door and knocking on the door and asking for pie. And so I sort of maybe in October started asking the guy who had the lease if we could open up for one day at Thanksgiving just to sell pie. And he said no. And, you know, I sort of asked him every single day. It became a joke. And, you know, finally maybe three days before Thanksgiving in 1990, he said that we could open for one day.
Mm.
And so we got the place ready in one day, opened up, and sold a bunch of pie. And the next day had Thanksgiving dinner for a bunch of friends because it was all cleaned up. And my partner then and I got drunk, and I suggested that we just open the next day too because the guy wasn't around who had the lease. And so we did. And he didn't show up for another 3 weeks. And when he did come in, we were very busy for lunch. And he looked at me and I was like, oh, God, I'm so sorry. He's like, whatever. And he just said, keep going. And then we ended up just working it out in April.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, but it's interesting that you wanted kind of pursuing your career as an artist, but then you suddenly decided to just, you know, open this pie place.
Well, first of all, I do feel like pies and cooking is an art, and also I had to pay rent, and you know, I didn't feel that I was ever going to make a living off of art, and I really was not happy working for other people. So even though it took a very, very long time before I was able to do art on a regular basis, I think it did work out in the long run.
Right. So the concept of Bubby's, how do you describe it?
Well, I would call it American home cooking, but, you know, with very thoughtfully sourced ingredients.
So what's where does that concept come from? Your childhood or?
Well, initially I would say yes, it comes from my childhood. In the long run, I've always been very proud of being an American, and of the way that different groups of people have come to America and they bring their food with them. And inevitably, the way that that food is incorporated into the American table is sort of representative of how those people are incorporated onto the American landscape. And it happens for different reasons at different times. So this is obviously a good time to be looking at that, the political landscape, and to see what America really is.
Mm.
So for me, it's about really everybody sitting down at a table and sharing the food that they sort of grew up with, which is very much based on culture and region and all kinds of things like that.
Right. Mm.
And taking the time to understand that there are people, it's about a community of people who produce all the food that we also eat, and there's a lot to it. You know, there's a lot of waste that could be stopped, and there's a lot of sort of appreciation that I think that comes through really sitting at the table and having a conversation and participating in the food situation.
Right. So I understand you are deeply rooted, have close relationships with the producers, and you make everything from scratch that you're known for. But sounds like, you know, your menu items are very classic American.
Yes.
Versus, you know, like just you just described, so many immigrants influence, bring in so many different things to this country. So it's like, is your place almost like providing the clean slate for new immigrants, or?
I would not say that.
No?
Bubby's not political.
Mm.
Except for it is political to make decisions to build a community within your business relationships, which for us means supporting local farms. And really, you know, that's all sounds good, but there's a lot of detail to that, and a lot of communication and relationship building that has to happen over a long time. And farmers, especially 20 years ago, really don't, you know, historically farmers don't trust other people.
Mm.
And part of the reason for that is because farmers really have to work very, very hard, and people, I think it's very much underappreciated how much weather and hours and what time you have to get going in the morning and all of the planning that goes through farming and the sort of risks involved and getting it to market and choosing what to sell and what not to sell. It's a very big job. And I think that farmers often feel very underappreciated.
It's almost exploited. And it's probably...
Yes. Like, well, it's sort of invisible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're obviously, farming is very, very important.
Right. I think that's the beginning, almost the beginning of the time New York City started to have green markets and CSA maybe.
Yes.
So it was pre-educational time for farming.
Yeah.
Right. So that's amazing. You already started back then.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a place that had that available.
Right.
And it really was about just getting the best things. The strawberries, local strawberries, are always better than ones that are flown in from California or Mexico.
Mm, right. So what are the examples that you make from scratch at Bubby's?
Well, we make jam, soda pop, pie crust. We make everything, really. You know, we used to make all of our own bacon, 1,100 pounds a week. But it's Tribeca, and so that was causing a lot of issues for the neighbors. So we have somebody upstate in Sullivan County that does that for us.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
But, the big things like that. So, I mean, we really try to make everything from scratch. I make root beer, you know, anything. But we also just, you know, really try to use local ingredients as much as possible and look at good farming practices that are sustainable in smaller operations and things like that.
Well, that's amazing. Nowadays, people started to cure meat and make vinegar and those things. But even 20 years ago, no, it's almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Right, you started it. So I had no clue how it's feasible to make root beer in a restaurant.
Well, you just have to do it.
Right. Okay, so who come to Bubby's in New York? What kind of customers?
Well, so many people, many different customers. We have a lot of local people and kids, families, business people, tourists, movie stars, lots of famous people.
Right, it really shows that Bubby's menu is so universally appealing.
I think Bubby's menu is universally appealing. Even, you know, we have 6 stores in Japan, and it's very much loved in Japan.
Right, so let's get into
Sorry to
that.
Jump to Japan, but I was just thinking about how universally...
Yeah, right. Well, it really totally makes sense because I really didn't know until recently that you have expanded to Japan.
Yeah.
So
it's our 10th anniversary this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. How did I not know? Okay, so let's talk about Bubbies in Japan. So how did it start in the first place?
Well, it started with my partners reached out to me just completely out of the blue because J.R. East wanted to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Commodore Perry coming to Yokohama Harbor.
So, by the way, J.R. East is a former national railway company. Now it's broken into semi-private.
Right.
I mean, private. So they have a lot of promotional events.
They have a lot of promotional events, and they have a lot of real estate that they, you know, so they wanted to use this space to celebrate the relationship and to get an authentic American restaurant to be in, you know, in this plaza in Yokohama.
Right. Well, actually, because like you said, it's owned by, originally owned by national government, so there are a lot of space along the old railway stations, which is pretty active, and
yes,
it's kind of like, you know, it's really the key transportation method in Japan.
Yes. Well, right. 85% of the population lives within, you know, a mile of the railroad station, I think.
Oh, by the way, I when we go to Japan, I have no intention to shop anything, but just like walking around, you know, before getting on the train or, you know, Shinkansen, I just end up buying a lot of stuff because so many good shops and events going on.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, so the JL East came to you.
Yes. And at first I didn't think that I was so interested in it. And they really convinced me to just fly over and look at the project, and you know, it seemed interesting, and they all of my interactions with my Japanese partners from the very beginning have been really based on goodwill and trust and everybody just going along with. So it's been a good experience in that way.
Well, I would assume someone came to Bubbies in Tribeca and had a good time.
Yes. Well, my sort of counterpart in Tokyo grew up in New York City. His father owned a restaurant in New York called Nirvana.
Right.
And so his name is Warren, Warren Wadud. And, you know, Warren really grew up coming to Bubbies when he was younger, going to school. And he seemed convinced when JR approached my partners, MRS, he was convinced when they approached him that Bubbies would be a good fit. And he really did make it happen.
Right. So he's based in Japan.
He lives in Tokyo now, yes. He has a family. He's married to a Japanese wife. And
Right. So, by the way, this MRS is it's a major company which owns 10 restaurants, including 4 brands from abroad, the Singapore, like the New Barn in New York, and Prime 42 by Nebraska Farms. And the Bubbies.
And Singapore Seafood Republic.
Right.
They have a ramen shop.
Right. Yeah. So it's really experienced. And they are experienced in bringing foreign brands to Japan as well.
Yes.
Right. So, but before the show, we had a quick conversation about your perception about Japan before this whole project. So you said you used to hate Japan, everything Japan.
Well, you know, For one thing, I'm very lazy when it comes to learning something completely new. So I've traveled a lot in my life, and if I go to Italy or France or Spain, I have a pretty deep understanding of that culture. It's Western civilization. So when I first landed in Japan, I was completely confused, but only for the first 6 or 7 years, really. I really could never understand what was going on. And it felt very much like one of those things that you have to sort of squint your eyes and stare at, and I never could figure those out. So I think one day I really was just walking along in Aoyama, and something clicked with me that everything just seemed beautiful and perfectly in balance. I don't know what happened. But after that, I've been very much obsessed. But even before that, you know, as an artist, I really discovered the beauty of Japanese materials and paper and ink and pigments, watercolors, and as we were talking about before, I, you know, developed a very sort of deep relationship with this artist Hokusai.
So Hokusai, Kazushita Hokusai, he's from the Edo period.
Yeah.
And he painted a lot of beautiful, kind of like, you know,
manga.
Yeah. Right. So it's a kind of comic.
He invented manga, really, right?
Right.
Kind of.
And I think there's a museum in Kanazawa.
Yeah.
And have you been there?
Yes.
Yeah. I couldn't believe how much I got into him.
He's amazing.
So it's really, he depicts beautiful daily life of human beings in Japan as well as nature.
Yes.
Like oceans and...
Yes, Fuji.
Right.
And yes, everything just sort of regular life. And you could really see that he, even though he was a sort of national treasure, everybody just ignored him. And he just was off to the side observing.
Right.
So he's very... simpatico, interesting, and, you know, also had a very wild life, and his daughter ended up just sort of following around, taking care of him in the last years of his life. But, you know, he was married a lot of times, and he just seemed to sort of throw himself out there fully.
Right. Actually, there is an animation about his daughter, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
I want to see that.
Yes, I think it's there was a subtitle.
So but I think also another interesting thing about him is that he really is, when Japan did open up to the West, Hokusai was the artist that really migrated to Europe, and sort of there was a real introduction of Japan, and that had a very deep impact on all kinds of art in Japan. Matisse and you know, a lot of different, you know, not Matisse, but
right. Well, you see those
artists, but early, you know, impressionists.
Right,
artists.
Right. I think that's really true. It's really widely. It's not just a few.
No, like everybody.
Right. So, okay, and so sounds like you clicked with the artistic side of Japan.
Yes. Very much.
Right. And you also mentioned the coffee.
Coffee. I love it. I mean, I love the coffee scene in Japan. I think what I was really mentioning is just I went to some little farmer's market, and there were probably 8 different very small coffee producers pouring, you know, pouring coffee in their own little way. And also there was this woman who at Tsukiji, before it turned over, you know, before the market moved, and really maybe 8 or 10 years ago when I was first there, she must have been making coffee in Tsukiji for 50 years. So I don't know. It seemed like a very deep subject in Japan, coffee.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it's about commitment to the quality, and it's almost like you have to, it's like meditative mindset in a way.
Well, I met this man once. I think he has a company called Life Coffee and in Tokyo, and he's been importing coffee from Brazil since the 1950s. He himself went there and just found the right coffee to import, and you know, he's like a sort of Zen master of coffee.
It was a totally before, a long time before the third wave coffee.
It's first wave coffee.
Right. He was doing the third wave in the first wave.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, let's discuss your interesting experience in Japan more. So, listeners, please stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Andrew Friedman, and I'm the host of Andrew Talks to Chefs here on HRN. Every week, I interview a diverse cross-section of the best and biggest names in professional cooking. Give a listen and get to know all about the inner lives of chefs. You can find Andrew Talks to Chefs wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Ron Silver, the chef owner of Bubby's in New York City, as well as six locations of Bubby's in Japan. So what was the biggest challenge in opening Bubby's and operating Bubby's in New York and in Tokyo?
Well... there were so many challenges.
I kind of expected it.
First of all, I'm sort of famous for not the best thing in Japan, which is a like when we first started, the Bubby's crew in Japan came and trained for 3 weeks, and I was very adamant because I kind of had heard some things. I was like, you guys have to use fresh ingredients for everything.
Right. Well, by the way, it's licensing. So it's the whole concept of the menu, fresh ingredients and the classic American. And that's the core.
Yes. American food made by hand and with some attention to what's going on.
Mm.
So, I was very, very clear about the freshness of everything. And, one of the things that they said is that lemons are very expensive in Japan.
Mm.
It's like, well, then you have to charge more for the lemonade, but you have to use it fresh, lemons for sure. So the day that they got back, they went to work, and the F&B purchasing guy called me directly and he said, by fresh, do you mean frozen? And I was like, no, I don't. And so he said, okay. And so the next day he called me and said, by fresh, do you mean canned? And I said, excuse my language. I said, I mean fucking fresh. And so I was very adamant about it. And I said that a whole bunch of times.
Mm.
And so when I showed up to the opening, there was a sign in the plaza that said fucking fresh lemonade. And in the restaurant, it said fucking fresh food. And I was like, all right, I'm happy about that because I think they really understood what I was saying.
Mm.
So, but there were many, many, many language issues about what fresh is, or not to serve, say, salad with pancakes, and all kinds of little weird things to try to understand. And I think that over time, it's very much been a learning on both sides about what is good, and also I have a real relationship with the chefs there, the baker there, the purchasing guys. You know, it's been 10 years, and we have a real relationship. And at first, Bubby's is not a normal business. I don't have a lot of standard operating procedures written out, and I'm sure they had never worked with anybody, you know, as unprofessional as I am in their lives.
Artist.
Yeah.
But it's great that you have to be stubborn, because, you know, I think there are many brands from this country brought into Japan, and it's kind of localized too much that you don't see the identity of the original concept. It's kind of like totally smoothed out. And
well, a lot of sentences start out with the Japanese people like this. I'm like, dude, you brought us over here. Let's just do what, you know, let's offer them this other thing. They will like it.
Mm.
So, and it really has, it's, you know, many brands go to Japan from America and not very many do well. And it really, it's not just a question of support. It's not a question of all the time about management, although those are very important things, who you go into business with. And, you know, I really have the best partners to be in business with, because they over time, over this time, we've really grown a mutual trust and respect for each other. And, you know, I've really come to understand the Japanese way of thinking about doing business, which is much more based on honor and handshakes and integrity. And I really do appreciate that very much.
Mm. So it takes time to establish that kind of trust-based relationship. But once it's established, it really is solid. So
well, it's like a lifelong relationship.
Right. Just like lifetime employment.
Well, you know, that whole idea is a very tricky idea, the lifetime employment idea, which is big in Japan,
right.
In a way, and not necessarily always the best thing if you need to get somebody out of the way, because they're, you know, one bad apple can ruin a whole team spirit.
Right.
And so that's been a big subject for us of how to sort of move people out of the way. You know, it takes time to build a solid team. And in Japan, just like very much like in New York City, we have a solid team. We have people in Japan that have worked there from day one.
Right.
And, you know, they text. I mean, we're friends. I'm friends with these guys. And so, and they've spent so much time here in New York, and I've spent so much time with them there, that we really have a good relationship.
Right. So, yeah, I think that's that lifetime employment concept. It's kind of risky too, but I think in a way, if you have a basic ease of being here as a valuable individual, people try to contribute more if you are staying in a good place. So that was, I think, that worked, like my father's generation after World War II. But now I think it's kind of like everything is becoming different.
Well, I do think it's a very good policy for companies to take their people seriously and to not just look at them as a commodity that can come and go. I just think at a certain point, if somebody, I've just seen where people are actually doing harm to the company, and there's just a long, 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 long response time on that.
Right.
But as opposed to in America, we'll just fire somebody because they sort of have messy hair, which I obviously would be fired every day of my life. So like all of the things in Japan, I think it requires patience to not just say, well, get rid of that guy. It requires having to work with somebody, and it also just requires not having to have things perfect all the time.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, it's just it is no right answer.
Right.
But, you know, it's the kind of difference in which value to prioritize.
Right? Well, and so. I think that there's everything to be said about building communities that are solid and not under in fear all the time. Like I don't like the American way of doing things in that way. So I've come to very much appreciate Japanese philosophy on even on lifetime employment, even though I know that I'm going to kill myself for saying that later.
Right. you know, as a result of the 10-year relationship, so do you still have to adjust the menu for the local palate or preference?
We do. You know, some of that has been sneaky because I've had to sneak Kirby cucumbers in to get pickles and get these guys in Hiroshima to grow them.
Ooh.
And then we also use these Hiroshima lemons for lemonade when they're in season, which are amazing lemons. And we also make Hiroshima lemon meringue pie and also the apples in Aomori. We have a very good relationship with the apple guys in Aomori. And we now have a new weird relationship with these ume farmers in Wakayama, where, you know, I've found the love of my life is the ume plum.
So umeboshi, usually it's a salt cured.
Yeah, so 80% of the ume is turned into umeboshi. And then the rest basically is turned into sort of umeshu or little pastes or things like that. But I really, and they flew me there just to try to think about it in a different way. And I feel like I did do that. And now I really am in a giant relationship with these Wakayamans.
Wow.
Which I love it down there. It's so weird, that right. place.
So for listeners who's not familiar with umeboshi has saltiness and some good acidity. And it's almost like act as flavorful salt in terms of, you know, imparting the flavor.
Thing that you put on a salad or have for breakfast, maybe just a little weird salty fermented thing.
And people used to use it as, you know, they put it in the middle of a white rice because it killed germs.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, and it also has a lot of good health benefits, apparently, a lot of antibacterial health stuff. I don't know. The ume is an amazing thing.
Right. So ume per day makes you living longer.
They say that.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So so the customers are everybody in Japan?
We get a lot of Japanese customers, and we get a lot of expats. You know, it's, I mean, we have 6 restaurants there, so each place has a different sort of, you know, customer base.
Station. Five in Tokyo, in the middle of cool area, office buildings.
Kichijoji.
Right, that's more like residential, like Brooklyn of Tokyo.
And Roppongi Hills, Shibuya.
Right. So probably you cover all the population, from young to old, to cool to families.
Well, and people, you know, in Japan, things become just sort of trendy. So pancakes is a big thing in Japan at the moment, or has been for the last while. Eggs Benedict, a lot of things that we do. Pie.
Right.
And, you know, Bubby's has had a good impact on the sort of the American food scene in in Tokyo, I think.
I'm glad you're doing it because I think Tokyo, not just Tokyo, but Japan tend to have more classic European pastry to French, Italian.
Yes.
But then somehow American food doesn't get sort of like...
Well, they have the Denny's and the sort of knockoff Jonathan's kind of, you know, but that level of food really does get a short
shrift. They're more, you know, mixed with Japanese flavors.
That's
too.
True, yes.
So you are really showing what American food is culturally too.
Yes. And I think that we're very much, like I said, trying to interact with agriculture and the communities to sort of really be participating in that way as well.
So I think that's another way you're inspiring, you know, the whole community society, because you're directly growing cucumber.
And but they're not that happy about bringing these new genetics in.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in fact, I probably shouldn't even talk about it because they'll probably come get me in the night, these guys. You know, I sent packets of seeds and they grabbed them in the mail. So then I brought them with me.
There's no evidence.
Well, there's the evidence of the genetics of the cucumbers that are growing in Hiroshima right now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe someone else did it.
Yeah. Maybe.
Right. So, okay. So how often do you get to visit Japan?
Twice a year.
Mm.
Mostly. Sometimes I go one more time, but...
Mm. So is that the mandatory?
I usually go in April or May. This year I have an art show in... I don't even remember where. Somewhere cool.
Mm.
And so I'm going in May and going down to Wakayama. And then
for the plum.
I go in September or October.
Mm. So is that a part of the agreement, licensing agreement?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. So how do you have any other outside kitchen experience with Japan? Like, you know, good or bad, crazy experience with the Japanese culture?
What do you mean by that?
You know, you had a really negative view to now. You're becoming almost like internalized.
Yes, I mean, like I said, it was all very foreign to me, and I had a lot of judgments on how things were set up, especially in a way. I had a weird reaction to how Japanese women are treated in general, and I felt judgmental about the sort of lack of clarity in communication, and I really had no understanding of the history of Japan, so it was like very much just being someplace that I had no idea what was going on. And then at some point I really did start to understand what was going on. And
maybe Hokusai showed you the history.
Hokusai, yes, I love him so much.
Right, so it's good that you are an artist and there's a connective point that you found that's really quintessential Japanese. That's Hokusai. So
yes, I have this art show in Osaka in May. So, and a lot of it is on washi, the stuff.
Oh, wow, more Japanese paper.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Maybe we should do another episode about your artist's side of it. Okay. So, what do you think about bringing an American-Russian concept to Japan? Like, you know, if somebody is thinking about it, you know, maybe my brand goes to Japan. Do you have anything that you would advise what to keep in mind?
Well, I'd say that it's not an easy thing to pull off, and you have to very, very much go in with an open mind. And like you said, be a little stubborn and clear about what you really want, and, you know, help to make it happen. I think that I think it's really a question of building good relationships and making sure that you enter into it with the right people to, you know, which is always the tricky part of any partnership.
Right. So the existence of Warren, who you...
Warren is a very, very big deal. Warren really communicates all of my thoughts. Warren understands me really well. We speak all the time. And, you know, he kind of is my agent. You know, it's like, I'm a liability a lot of times. Warren really manages me every step of the way and also makes sure that I get what I, you know, what I want or... you know, need not. I really try to not be too.
Right. Maybe he's feeling responsible because he's the one who's invited you.
Well, he totally did. He is responsible. You know, he really did a great job and continues to do a great job.
So the local partner that you can trust.
100%.
Right. Okay. So what's your plan with Bubbies? Are you opening more Bubbies in Japan here or anywhere?
That's a good question. I'm open to it. Bubbies is doing really, really, really well, better than ever. And I'm inclined to enjoy that before piling on a bunch of stuff. I also have this cannabis business, and I'm working with introducing that CBD to Japan.
Oh, wow.
So I hate to pop that out at the end of the interview, but that is a very big deal.
Is it possible? Because
it is. Yes. And
for the medical appeal.
Well... it's a very large conversation. It's legal. It's going to happen, and it's exciting. And I think it's going to help Japan a lot. And quite frankly, they should legalize weed as well. because the reason it's not legal there is because of American manipulation. Mm. And it would very much help the aging population in Japan mm-hmm. to take a bunch of bong hits.
Right. yeah, and even New York City, they just kind of banned edible CBD used in...
It really makes me mad, but we're really going to do something to try to change that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. So that's relaxation effect, that's, I think, is...
Also anti-inflammatory. There's a lot of benefits to it, but the point is that, you know, rather than opening up new restaurants at the moment, I'm very much focused on that.
Mm.
We'll see what happens.
Right. So you have a trust in the power of CBD, which kind of changes community.
100%, yes.
So where did that idea come from?
Well, I have been using cannabis since I was about 2.
Mm.
So that idea came from somewhere outside of myself, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, I think it's good for the government if it's, you know, THC or CBD. You know, I think it's rather than going to somewhere else, you should go to the government.
It's an insane thing to have it be illegal. That's a whole discussion.
Right. Yeah, it's the same as maybe alcohol, like prohibition that we experienced.
Yes, but alcohol only has one use, which is to get drunk. And, you know, cannabis has many, 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 many right. applications.
Right. Without that kind of excessive consumption of alcohol
right.
leading to so many different...
Well, especially in Japan, if you picture walking through Roppongi at night, 2 a.m, you see some very nasty things.
Mm.
Businessmen, you know, passed out in the street.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. And on the last train, almost everybody was half asleep.
Yes.
On the subway. Right. So... Yeah, that's interesting. There should be another way for people, stress out Japanese people, to relax.
There is.
Right.
It's coming.
Mm. Okay, so please keep me posted.
All right.
All right. So where can we find you, your latest update online?
I have no idea. I don't really...
At Bubbies.com,
mm-hmm. yes.
Right. And so, the Japanese one's Bubbies.jp.
Right.
I found. And... Okay, and your CBD product, that's the...
Yeah, our CBD product is called Azuka.
Mm.
And you can find that at azuka.co.
It's azuca.co.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us today, Lawrence. So please keep me posted.
Thank you.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the shows or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@theheritageradionetwork.org or at kikuatema.com. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.